Well, hello, everybody. It is April the 13th, 1:10 p.m. here on the West Coast of the United States of America. It's kind of gloomy here in Southern California, but that's okay. We had a little bit of sunshine, and hopefully we'll get back to that as well. I'm very excited for today's podcast because the person that I'm going to be speaking with was one of my professors and was and is a friend. And I get to bounce a lot of really cool ideas off of him, and he's a mentor and a guide. And so I'm just super excited that we've been able to have him on, and specifically on this subject, because I know he's been talking about another subject quite a bit. So I didn't want to get him on that subject. I didn't want to bring him in to discuss that subject because I know there's so much content out there on that subject. We'll be speaking about that. And so without any further ado, I'm going to introduce Dr. Doug Guyvett. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Yeah, we hadn't spoken, and then I got a text from you the other day where you were talking to a mutual friend who is in Armenia, and you're like, "Yeah, I'm talking to Jacob." And Jacob's been on the podcast, by the way. We've talked about kind of Armenian-Turkish-Azeri relations. And you guys were talking about some of your recent work that you've been doing, and everything we're talking about, all the links to those things are in the description box. So if people want to purchase those books and look at that content, you're more than welcome to do so. So what was that subject you guys were talking about?
Well, so Holly Pivick and I have co-authored a couple of books on something called the New Apostolic Reformation. And our most recent book came out just a few months ago. It's called Counterfeit Kingdom. And the subtitle is The Dangers of New Revelation, New Prophets, and New Age Practices in the Church. And we've been doing a number of interviews, quite a few podcasts out there now about the book. So people that are interested in that topic can tune in for that or look for the book. I would encourage that. Your friend Jacob reached out to us because he was running into people in his ministry in Armenia and other parts of the world who have been influenced by the New Apostolic Reformation. And somebody referred him to our book, and then he reached out to us, and we had a great time just talking. That was a private conversation that we had by Zoom. Yeah. I think he was in Korea at the time.
Yeah, he's somewhere all the time.
Yeah.
He was. I think he was speaking at a missions conference in Korea.
He's built
for missionary work.
So it was great to get acquainted. And then I said, "Well, you know, I have a former student who spent some years in Armenia." And he said, "Oh, would that be Arthur?" He called you Arturo. And I said, yes. So I texted you that we were in a Zoom meeting. And that's how you and I reconnected most recently. Yeah.
Yes. So the books that you guys, I have two of them, God's Super Apostles.
Yes.
Which is a thinner book. This is maybe a quicker read.
Yes.
And then we have The New Apostolic Reformation, which the subtitle says A Biblical Response to a Worldwide Movement. And the third one, I'm going to get on most likely on audiobook. I don't have that with me, and I haven't read that or haven't listened to it, but I think you have it with you.
Yeah. I can show you what it looks like. It's called Counterfeit Kingdom. And it is the most recent book. Holly and I will be in Bellevue, Washington, in the Seattle area next weekend, and we'll be speaking together on this topic. So there's a lot of interest, and we're hearing a lot of feedback from people who are reading the book. We just learned of a women's apologetics group that has adopted this book for their discussion, and they had their first meeting this week. So we know of many interesting discussions that have been stimulated by this recent work we've done.
Yeah. And I think just in the YouTube space, there's a lot of this stuff. There's a lot of people who, I mean, there's just a general, I know, charismatic Pentecostal circles where people call themselves apostles or prophets. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they mean something completely different than the stuff that you guys are talking about.
That's right. And what we're doing is a critique, and it's a biblically, theologically based critique. It is not a critique of classical Pentecostalism or the charismatic movement. And we have friends on all sides of the divide, some who are continuationists and some who are cessationists. Mm-hmm. And find that in both cases, people are helped by this book because we're addressing a different problem in the church today with the new apostles and prophets associated with groups like Bethel Church in Redding, California, under the apostle Bill Johnson and his prophet Chris Valaton. But there are so many others as well that are networked with this group.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing that work. You are currently Professor Emeritus. You have retired from your post at Biola, but I want to quickly read your credentials for those that might not know you. And then I want to ask you some personal questions before we get into our subject today. Mm-hmm. You have a Bachelor's of Science degree from Multnomah School of the Bible. And then you have an MA from Gonzaga University, and then another MA from Dallas Theological Seminary, and a PhD from the University of Southern California. You have been one of those Christian philosophers who's been at the forefront of doing apologetics for many, many years. And if I throw names out there, some people will be like, yeah, I know those guys, right? Especially some of the Talbot folks. If mm-hmm. we say Dr. J.P. Moreland, people are going to be like, yep, know him. And if they say Dr. William Lane Craig, people are going to say, yep, know him too. If I say Dr. Doug Guyvett, people go, not sure, but you've been doing quite a bit of work. And you, I kind of look at you as like a hidden gem from that Talbot group. Just from the top of your head, do you know how many books that you've written or kind of contributed to and academic articles?
I don't. I don't know.
I was going through your CV and I just had to keep scrolling.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit of work you've done, and it's just phenomenal.
I've been doing this for a while. You know, I taught for over 30 years at the university level. And of course you were one of my students, and that's been a number of years ago. So, you know, over time, as you're asked to do various things, if you keep at it, then it does tend to achieve kind of a dizzying amount of material to keep up with, I guess, but, for some people.
But you've also done like such a wide range of writing for a philosopher. So you've written on the problem of evil. You've done film and philosophy. Mm-hmm. But now you're doing New Apostolic Reformation stuff. You've done just philosophy. I mean, epistemology is kind of where you've been at for a very long time, along with apologetics. It's interesting because a lot of philosophers don't go into that wide range. They might find like ethics and then just stick to it. You have a very wide range of things that you've written on. Why?
Well, for me, it's because my interests are so varied and I read in all these different areas. And then some of the reason is practical. I see practical needs in the church and in the world for ideas and for logic and sound thinking to be applied to popular notions that are spreading around the culture. And so, in philosophy, of course, we're dealing with a discipline that has application to just about anything you could imagine. Any topic that you might bring up would be a topic that could be subject to philosophical consideration. And so it's a great field for me because my interests are so varied to be able to interact. And I've always gotten a little, I'll write about a topic that's a matter of interest to me and that I care about. And then if I feel that I've said pretty much all that I've got to say about it, I do like to move on to other things. And even in my teaching, I've liked to have different courses all through the years, just to kind of stay fresh and to have something, you know, new to challenge myself and to talk about with students. And there's just no end to the possibilities of topics that are of interest and of real necessity and concern in the world today.
Yes, that's true. That is. And that's one of the cool things about philosophy, because you get to interact with every single subject that's out there. Because there's a philosophy of everything.
That's true. Yeah. Oh, that's for sure. You know, I was reading today in a book by a theologian about one of the virtues on the list of the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5 about joy. And he just had a statement that he made on the side about how sport is a field where you, if you're a participant or if you just cheer on a team that you've adopted, you experience joy when there's victory, and then you experience sadness and defeat when your team loses. And he was talking about how this is just one reason why people engage in sport is because it's like a microcosm of the human experience, where we have to wrestle with challenges in life. And sometimes we come out on the winning end and sometimes we don't. And so, you know, he was beginning to step in a little bit to the philosophy of sport there, wasn't he?
Correct. Yes. Yes. But people can't escape it. People really can't escape doing philosophy.
Hmm. Yes. You know, and you will either be good at it or mediocre or worse. And so, of course, if it's a fruitful avenue of reflection and exploration into the nature of reality and the things that we commit to, then it deserves our attention, and we should do it well. We should do it with energy, but we should do it with expertise and excellence as well.
Correct. Some practical advice you might want to give to people who are maybe starting their academic journey, maybe, you know, they're just fresh out of high school, who might be watching this, or some people who might have done that already and are either considering immediately going into graduate school, or maybe even haven't taken a break and are now saying, hey, I want to go into this. What were some things you've learned, you know, managing family and children and just life and work, and then doing academic studies as well?
Well, the academic life is a wonderful form of life. For me, it has been. I enjoy the engagement with ideas and the role of a teacher that includes lifelong learning for myself. And I've always had very good students. I've been blessed with the best students you could hope for. And they're passionate, and they're mature, and they're thoughtful and intelligent. And they come to these questions with real seriousness and interest. And yet they're down-to-earth people, too. And so it's great to have been a kind of mediator for them into the discipline. And it's true that over the years, I've had hundreds of students, and a couple of hundred or more have gone on to do graduate research in philosophy. And so that's very gratifying. And then the others, though they haven't gone down that path, are using philosophy on a routine basis in the work that they do. I think you're an example of that, Arthur.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it has been so helpful just to be able to look at an idea or someone says something and kind of have the ability to break it down and say, well, there's an assumption, there's an underlying assumption here. Let's deal with that underlying assumption. And maybe there is a philosophical idea out there that might not be very biblical. And I definitely would not have been able to do that without studying under you and folks like you. Mm-hmm. So thank you. You've improved my life.
Well, and you were in school with others like yourself, and iron sharpens iron, right? So I'm sure that the experience that you had was enriched by being, you know, rubbing shoulders with others that were studying the same things that you were at the time, and you were growing together into this form of life and the intellectual life that needs to be applied in very practical ways.
Correct. Yes. It's always good to be with a group of folks that are, you know, you're reasoning through stuff, and you need people to come alongside who are maybe a little further ahead or not so in their journey, and bounce ideas off of one another. I want to switch gears here and jump into our subject. We're talking about religious epistemology. I mean, that's now there's this book that you worked on. quite a contemporary perspectives on religious epistemology.
Yes.
This is a book full of articles, and it has all sorts of folks in it. So for somebody looking at it might say, well, you know, Dr. Guyvet is a Christian. I'm not very sure. The first chapter in this book is by Anthony Flew, who was a leading atheist for many years, and it's the presumption of atheism. Which essentially he's saying that it is the burden of proof is on the theist, not the atheist, to prove their case. So let's define what a belief is first, because it's a word that we use maybe often. I believe this or I believe that. Mm-hmm. But maybe we don't think as deeply about what we mean by that word. How would you define what a belief is?
Yeah. Well, in the field of philosophy, it's defined as a propositional attitude. It's a mental state. So you have a belief as a function of some content that's in your mind. And of course, your mind can hold contents of various sorts. And in the case of belief, it's a matter of holding to something, to a proposition, affirming the proposition. A belief is a pro-attitude. It's a positive attitude or take on a proposition. And it's a particular kind of pro-attitude or positive attitude. You could contemplate a proposition like God exists. And you might not believe it or disbelieve it. You might just be thinking about it. And your mind is working on the question, is this proposition true or not? And what if it was true? Would I want to believe it? On what grounds would I be prepared to believe it or not? And then what difference would it make in my life if I did believe it? You can have all those thoughts without actually having the belief that God exists. But when you have the belief that God exists, now you've adopted a particular attitude towards the proposition. And it's the attitude of holding that the proposition is true. So to believe the proposition, God exists, is to adopt the attitude that it is true that God exists. Now, if you believe that God does not exist, that's a proposition as well. The proposition, God does not exist. And there you think, now, instead, that's the proposition that's true. And so belief is just a matter of what attitude you adopt toward a given proposition. And it could be a proposition with profound significance and implications, like the proposition God exists, or it could be something as simple as, this is a pen. That's a proposition as well. It's a pen with a blue cap, you might say. And so that proposition is maybe not that interesting to consider, but it's either true or false. And if you believe it, then that means that you hold or have the attitude that it is true. Now, you could have an attitude towards a proposition that's favorable, a favorable attitude towards it, without believing that it's true. You might think, well, you know, I'd like to believe that proposition, or it sure makes me feel good to consider that, or I might accept it in a certain sense so that I could live as if it's true, but I'm not really sure I believe it. So those are ways to adopt a favorable attitude towards a proposition without actually believing the proposition. But belief is a way that the mind clamps down in an affirmative, favorable way on the truth of a proposition, or in holding that it's true. Now, you can be mistaken, of course. If you have a false belief, then you believe the proposition is true, but when it's actually false. And so your belief is false if the proposition is false.
So there's something outside of you believing the thing that you can compare the thing to, essentially, to figure out whether it's true or false.
Yeah, so your belief is always about something. It's always of something or about something. The two examples I gave were beliefs about God and a pencil with a blue cap or a pen with a blue cap. very different kinds of objects. God is a spiritual being, if God exists, and a pen is a physical object in the physical world. So they're different in kind, and how you would come to believe that these things are true would depend on what you have to go on, what I call evidence. Mm-hmm. But yes, you know, you could be mistaken. I could hold up a pen and believe that the cap is green, and I would have a false belief about the color of the cap on the pen. But it would still be my attitude towards that proposition. And if I picked it up thinking that I would be getting green ink out of the pen and I started writing something where it needed to be green and it came out blue, well, then I'd be in trouble because I acted on a false belief.
Correct. So is the definition of a belief any different than what would we would generally call knowledge?
Yes. So that's important because in order to have knowledge, you have to have beliefs, but it's you have to have beliefs that are true. So if your beliefs, if your belief that the pen is a blue ink pen is false, then you won't be able to know that it's a blue ink pen. You can't know something that isn't true. So, but you do have to believe it to have knowledge. So at the very least, and this is not enough for knowledge, but at the very least, you must have a true belief in order to have knowledge. Now, you could have a true belief and not have knowledge, but you can't have knowledge without true belief. So you couldn't know that God exists unless God exists. He must exist in order for you to know that. And of course, if you didn't have the favorable attitude of belief towards the proposition, then you wouldn't have knowledge either. You know, here's a true proposition, let's say God exists, but until you believe it, you don't know it. Now, you might believe it and still not know it because you might just be guessing. It might just be guesswork for you, and you might just be lucky to get it right and to have a true belief. But if you have appropriate grounds for believing, then you can have knowledge. So knowledge requires a true belief on appropriate grounds.
So we've essentially spoken about the two aspects of what we would call justified true belief. Can you make a couple of comments on the justification aspect of that?
Yeah, so a very popular definition of knowledge is that it is justified true belief. And so you understand what I mean by true belief. The justified part of it is to have the grounds that you need for it to be more than a merely accidentally true belief, that you didn't just get lucky believing it, but that your belief is grounded in the right way. Something makes it likely that what you believe is true. Now, I didn't use the definition justified true belief myself, but my definition of adequately grounded true belief is similar in some ways, but it's more, I think it's important to be clear about the criteria that you need for your belief to be appropriately grounded. So you couldn't, you'd have to have justification of a certain sort and to the right degree in order to have knowledge. So I would be reluctant to say that a true belief was knowledge simply because it was justified. Because it might be that the justification you have for believing it is pretty weak. Yeah. So I'd want the justification to be strengthened enough for it to count as knowledge.
Understood. Are all beliefs equal? What do I mean by this? Should we make a differentiation between religious and non-religious beliefs? I say this because quite often in apologetics kind of conversations, atheists or just unbelievers will say, well, no, your belief is of a different sort or variety or something like that. Or are we to treat just, hey, you have a belief, it's your agreement or your attitude towards a proposition, and we'll just go with that. And then what we really need to talk about is the justification or the evidences, like you mentioned earlier.
Well, belief is very important for life because we act on the basis of what we believe. and are to the degree that we're more confident in what we believe, the better prepared we are to act on those beliefs. So when we're less confident about something we believe, we might believe it, but not be very prepared to act on it because we're just not sure of ourselves. When we think we have knowledge, then we think that we're in better shape to act in accordance with the things that we believe. And so we want to have, we want good hygiene in relation to our cognitive lives, because we want to have beliefs that we can act on responsibly, so that we can build our lives on a solid foundation of things that we should think really are true. And, you know, for example, here's a mundane example. If you and I were walking in downtown Los Angeles, let's say, and we came to a traffic light and there were lots of cars passing in front of us, we'd probably want to pay attention to whether or not it was safe to cross the street. And we'd have various indicators for that. But the question is it safe to cross the street? And one proposition says that it is, and another proposition says that it's not. And we want to believe what's true here, because if we step out off the curb before it's safe to cross, we might be run over, and that might be the last thing we ever do. So what are our indicators when we're trying to decide what's safe to do here? What's the responsible action? Well, we have the sound of the traffic. We have our visual data. As we see cars coming and going, we see there are traffic lights and signals for walking and not walking and so forth. And then I had the benefit of being with somebody else who has his wits about him. That's you. And you're seeing the same things. And if I think it's safe to step off the curb and you see a vehicle coming that I don't, you might grab my elbow and say, oh, wait, hold on. I don't think it's quite time to go here. And so we have all sorts of things to go on in deciding whether to believe it is now safe to cross the street. That's a mundane example, but it could make a difference to life or death. And of course, many other beliefs are more trivial than that, and some are much more important than that, like the belief that God exists, for example, because that should make a difference to the way you live your life and what curbs you're prepared to step off of, metaphorically speaking, and what traffic you're willing to step into if you believe that proposition rather than something else. So it's very important that in acting responsibly in the world, it's not enough to believe and have lots of conviction, because our beliefs don't make the things that we believe true. Truth doesn't happen because we believe things. And so, reality has a way of showing up whether we're right or not. And we want to get it right so that we can live productive lives and fulfilled lives and have meaning and purpose and so forth, and even be prepared for an afterlife if there is such a thing, and know what to do about that. So it's important to have the right sorts of grounds, indicators of what is true. That is what I call evidence. It's what we have to go on in believing the things that we believe.
So the example you gave, again, it was a mundane sort of example, but typically a response to an example like that from an atheist or an unbeliever would be, well, you have a lot of visual cues and, you know, you have a lot of kind of material things in front of you that are giving you this evidence in order for you to make the decisions or make come up to the beliefs or have the knowledge of what to do or not to do. But when we're talking about God, that's a completely different sort of thing. Mm-hmm. How would we approach a conversation like that?
Well, that's a good question. And how we know things of a particular sort depends on what sort of things they are. So I have beliefs about what is morally right and morally wrong, and most of us do. And sometimes we agree, in fact. We don't all agree about every moral judgment, but we all do generally make moral judgments, and we believe our judgments to be correct. Now, these are not physical things. Our beliefs are not about things in the physical world. They're about character. They're about actions. And they're about the quality that an action has. And so some people think that if you are fulfilling a duty that you can know that you have just rationally and logically, you are doing the right thing. But it's not as if you could put that under a microscope or that it could literally pass the smell test. The physical senses, our physical faculties, are not that much use to us in determining what is morally right and what is morally wrong. And yet we have we generally do make belief judgments about these things. And atheists do this as well. Naturalists do this as well. So there are things that we believe that have nothing to do with empirical data or empirical facts. And so our senses are not much use to us in knowing those kinds of truths. So the fact that knowing that there's a God would be a matter of knowing about the existence of a spiritual thing that you couldn't put under a microscope or see with the naked eye does not mean that it's not something at all knowable. We do make judgments about all sorts of things like that, and that can include other things that have nothing to do with ethics even, like beauty or numbers or the colors of things and so forth. So there are general terms that we use, and we make general claims. So, for example, we might say all ravens are black, but that might be a reasonable belief about all ravens. But we don't believe that because we've seen every raven there is and noted that it was black. There are many ravens I've never seen, and yet I do believe that they are black. Well, on what basis do I believe them? So there's something that you could know if you could get all the ravens in front of you and look at them and determine for yourself that they're black. That would be one way to know it. But nobody knows that all ravens are black that way. And so how do they know it? Well, there have to be other means of knowing things apart from our sensory faculties, even if our sensory faculties are important to getting to that point where we know even what it means for a raven to be black. Now, when it comes to God, that's the sort of thing that you might have reason to believe given things that you do observe in the physical world. So you could have indicators of the existence of a non-physical being like God, an agent, a creator, in order to make sense of the physical world that appears to be created or designed in some way or other. And so you infer the existence of God as the best explanation for the things that you actually are able to handle and hold and see and taste and smell and so forth. You can't do that with God, but you might be able to do it with things that God makes. Hmm. And so that gives you a reason to believe that there is a God.
Okay. The history of philosophy has had a lot of different opinions when it comes to knowledge. If we go back all the way to Plato, let's just say, but it's... maybe it's Plato, maybe it's Socrates. We'll leave that up to debate, where knowledge is seen as this thing that one is born with, and then it's a matter of remembrance. Mm-hmm. Plato justifies that in sort of kind of a incarnation or a reincarnation kind of idea, where you have access to information before you're born into the physical world. We don't really see many people believe that per se, but how should we approach the subject of knowledge? Are people actually born kind of in a neutral state? Are we born predisposed to certain ideas? I saw someone who was talking about how, parents, you guys need to relax because most of the stuff that your kids are going to, gravitate towards and like and dislike and be good at or not are genetically predisposed in them already. So you just kind of get to shepherd them rather than influence them in those areas. What about beliefs? Are beliefs actually, or can they even be neutral as some people want them to be? Like, you got to just approach every subject neutral till you have all the evidence provided to you. Then you can make a decision. Cause sort of like a computer, you would say, right? Like, you throw all the information into it and spits out an answer. Is it like that, or is it a lot more stuff going on to it?
Well, for you to acquire beliefs, you have to have the right sort. You have to be the right sort of thing. You have to be a cognitive being, a being that has a mind, and you have to have the right faculties. And so we may not be able to pinpoint that moment when any given individual, human individual, has achieved the minimal level of complexity and sophistication to be able to have a belief. But we know it happens pretty early on. And it's probably different, right, for different people. But you can't have a belief just because you have the faculties either. So your faculties have to have something to work with. data, right? Something has to come before the mind for belief. And so our earliest experiences in life provide us with data for belief. And we begin to acquire beliefs very early on. And then these begin to compound and build up into something that's more substantial. And then as our critical faculties mature and evolve, we're able to have beliefs about fairly complicated things. And then relate beliefs that we have about some things to beliefs that we have about other things. And what we hope is that ultimately, the beliefs that we accept, the ones that we favor, the propositions we think are true, will cohere with each other. And we want our beliefs to be true, and we want them to be appropriately grounded and related to each other in a way that's coherent, so that we have that framework within which to live our lives. So, but all of this begins in a very primitive way with first beliefs about things that are presented to our minds for belief.
Okay, so would you say, as some skeptics kind of approach this and say, no, you have to be skeptical towards everything, and then once you're convinced otherwise, then you would believe it. It seems to me that this is such a unnatural way of existence. As a matter of fact, I don't think we'd be able to do much if we approached everything. Say we had a child and we just trained them to be skeptical about everything, whether they'd be able to operate. Or are they're just these givens that we can just work with?
There aren't very many people who live a thoroughgoing skepticism. Now, they may say that they're skeptics, but most people who are skeptical and thoughtful in their skepticism are skeptical in a limited way, in a restricted way. So they're skeptical about certain claims and not others. And so now you could be thoroughly skeptical, and you might think, well, we don't know anything. We don't have knowledge at all, and we can never tell whether any of the beliefs that we have are true. Now, of course, that is a truth claim itself, and that is either true or false. The skeptic would then believe that, and he might be right or he might be wrong, but the question is, why believe it? Why should I be skeptical is the question. Why should I believe that I can't have knowledge? Can I know that I can't have knowledge? if so, well, then there's one thing I can know. And so I would have to say the only thing I can know is that anything else I believe is something I don't know. This is the only belief that I have that I know to be true. And yet the question would arise, well, why think that you know that that's true? What's your evidence? What's your grounds for that? And as soon as you admit grounds for believing some kind of skepticism, then you've allowed that grounds can make a difference to whether you should believe something or not. And then it could turn out that maybe your skepticism is too broad and too universal and too open-ended. And there are many things that you could be justified in believing since you've now opened the door to evidence or grounds for believing things appropriately. And so then the question is, well, does that leave anything left not to be skeptical about? And of course, that's a different extreme where you say we can know anything that we want to believe, All we have to do is put our minds to it and think about it hard enough and collect the evidence, and then we'll know. But there may be things that we can't know, that our capacities are too limited for knowledge, or we simply don't have what we need to go on yet to make a decision about that. And that's why science has this method, but it isn't that we have a complete science of everything yet, because there's so much that we know that we don't know.
Correct. What about if some people just come to like the religious question, right? The God question, and they say, no, this is the thing that you have to be skeptical about.
Yeah.
Is there grounds for that?
Well, that's the thing you have to ask. I mean, anytime if you disagree with such a person, if a person says, well, I think we should all be skeptical about the question, does God exist? We should just withhold belief and not believe one way or the other. You should ask the question, well, why think that? Well, on what basis did you come to that conclusion? That's what it would mean to have a responsible belief there. And the person might be right, but I wouldn't be prepared to believe that he was right just because that was his attitude. I'd want to know, what reasons do you have for saying we should just not decide one way or the other? Now, that means that we're going to have to wrestle with the evidence for and against the existence of God. And we really only have three options here. I mean, the proposition that God exists is either true or it is false. Those are the only possibilities. And if it's true, then we should want to believe that it's true. If it's false, we should want to believe that it's false. But we should want to believe it responsibly. We don't want to just accidentally get it right. So we have to consider the evidence. And that means we have to look at the evidence for the existence of God and the evidence against the existence of God and see how they measure up in relation to each other. And now we have three possibilities. While it's true that either God exists or God does not, when it comes to evidence, it may be that the evidence strongly indicates that God does exist, in which case you should believe it. Or it may be that the evidence strongly indicates that God does not exist, even if there is some evidence that God does exist. And in that case, you should believe that God does not exist. But what if your evidence is counterbalanced? What if it seems to you as if the evidence for the existence of God and the evidence against the existence of God are about the same in strength, that they're equally balanced? Well, then you wouldn't know what to believe. And so you'd probably be best off withholding belief and being agnostic and neither believing that God does exist nor believing that God does not exist. But notice that even if that's your attitude, one of agnosticism and non-belief, either way, that's based on evidence. And it's your assessment that the evidence is counterbalanced for and against, and that neither side benefits more than the other from the evidence, that's your reason to withhold judgment. Mm. So even withholding judgment requires a consideration of evidence if you want a reasonable agnosticism.
Now, you've participated in a lot of debates, both in print and also in person, live debates. Would it be your observation, and just agree or disagree with this? I mean, you can give details, but because it's sort of my observation that people come to the conversation about God and faith in God, presenting that skepticism somehow is a more intellectually honest position to take rather than belief. Have you seen that actually? Because that's an attitude question rather than data question, right? It's like, oh, I'm the skeptic. I'm being a lot more honest about this than the individual who's saying, no, I know this to be the case.
Right. So there's nothing inherently more honest about being skeptical. And if you're being honest with the evidence, it may be that you can't be skeptical, that you should actually believe that God exists. Or alternatively, you should be an atheist and not a skeptic if the evidence points in that direction. So skepticism by itself doesn't automatically have the default benefit of the doubt. There is no default here. You just have to go with the evidence you have to go on. And you might have to admit that you haven't really thought about it very much and that you're not too sure what the evidence for or against the proposition really is. And you might think that the responsible thing is to withhold judgment as a matter of practical concern because you haven't investigated the question. That's fair. But do you want to go on living indefinitely without considering the evidence for such a proposition as that? That's what you believe about God, whether it's that God exists or not, is probably the most important thing about you. Not everybody agrees with that, but I would argue for that is the case. So if you haven't thought about it before, that would be kind of unusual. But certainly there are many people who thought about it, but really don't think that they are in a position to make a decision because they're not that familiar with the evidence. And I would encourage them then to get themselves acquainted with the evidence so that they can make a reasonable decision that could make a real significant positive difference to their lives.
Hmm. I want to shift gears because some questions have come in. I want to give some time for them. Mm-hmm. One of them is, can a belief be justified to be true if it's a probability?
Yes. So not only that, but you could have knowledge based on probabilities, on my view. So Yes, and much of what I believe, I assume much of what you and others listening to this believe, would be based on probabilities. It's on the balance of the evidence they have, even if their evidence is not conclusive. So there's a term I've used to describe a class of evidence or a kind of degree of evidence that is so strong that maybe you couldn't even be mistaken. But we can't wait around to believe things based on that level of evidence, because there are many things that we're called upon to do and to think about that are not amenable to that kind of assessment. We may never have conclusive evidence for some of the things that we believe, and yet we should believe them. And so then it becomes a question, well, can you know them if you don't have conclusive evidence? Now, I think if you do have conclusive evidence, then you will have knowledge. But you might have knowledge even without conclusive evidence, as long as it's very good evidence. And so there's a sense in which your evidence does not guarantee that what you believe is true, but it is so secure given the evidence that the likelihood is incredibly small that you would be mistaken. And that, I think, is good enough for knowledge in many cases because of the way that we use the term knowledge. We claim to know all sorts of things for which we lack conclusive evidence.
Like what?
Well, almost anything for that matter. I don't know what your address is, but you probably have neighbors and beliefs about who lives across the street and so forth. I have neighbors, for example, that have just put their home up for sale. And I believe that they have not yet sold their home, though they've had a number of good offers. Now, I could be mistaken about that. I think my belief is pretty well grounded, but something might have transpired in the last hour or 2 hours or since I last spoke with them that I don't know about. And if I did have an awareness of that evidence, then my belief would be different than it is. So we do make adjustments in what we believe based on updates in the evidence that we receive. But by and large, we are thoughtful about whether we would claim to know something prematurely. And we know better than to think that we have knowledge if our evidence is spotty or inadequate or constantly changing and so forth. So, you know, it's a dynamic thing. Our cognitive lives are very dynamic, and our beliefs increase, the strength of belief increases, it rises and falls with the fortunes of evidence that we encounter. And you can go from not knowing a proposition to coming to knowing that it's true. And then later you might say, well, I don't know it anymore. I mean, I thought I did yesterday, but now encountering some other evidence, I might not say that today.
So I guess that takes us to some other questions that have come in, which is who determines whether or not the justification is strong?
Yeah, well, that's something you determine for yourself. Now, you can be mistaken about that, too. You can think that your belief is only weakly grounded when, in fact, it's pretty well grounded. And you're just a little reluctant to say that you have knowledge when maybe you do have knowledge. So you could have knowledge and think that you don't have knowledge, on my view. I don't think you have to believe that you know something, some proposition is true, in order to have knowledge. It just has to be true and grounded in the right way. Now, it may be that some things, when they are grounded in the right way for knowledge, will be things that you would know that you know. But I don't think that's a requirement for knowledge generally. You could know something and not even think that you know it.
How much do you think personality plays a factor into this?
Well, I guess that depends on what you mean by personality, but we have, different backgrounds and different concerns and different mental habits and different interests, and these can be a function of personality, and so that can make a difference to what you're prepared to contemplate. Some people might say, well, I'm not really an intellectual person. I don't really care that much about evidence, but But actually, they do. They do care quite a lot about evidence. It's just that they don't think about it as evidence. But when you're standing on the street corner, contemplating crossing a busy intersection, whether you're thinking about the evidence as evidence or not, you're collecting evidence, and the evidence is being presented to you, and the decision you make about crossing the street when you do is based on that evidence. It's just that you're so practiced in using evidence in a situation like that that you don't even think about doing that in a reflective way. You just do it. It's just automatic for you. And that's convenient for us. We're actually designed so that we can function that way. And that's a good thing, because we're able to weigh evidence of the rights of certain sorts efficiently so that we can get on with our lives and not always be, you know, bogged down trying to figure out things.
So like this immediately takes me to think about like Darwinian evolution has a high focus on like design, let's just say quotations. The design we have is for survivability, right? Or natural selection makes it in a way where one survives. When it comes to kind of our epistemic makeup, it seems like we're designed for truth seeking quite a bit.
Yeah.
How do we reconcile that if there is no God and everything is by chance and random?
Well, I believe that it's part of the human condition to be interested in truth. We are inherently truth interested. We are ineluctably truth interested is the way I like to put it, because that just means we can't help ourselves. We care about truth whether we admit it or not, whether we admit it to ourselves or not, and especially about the things that matter most. Now, there's broad agreement about what matters most, but then some things matter more to you than to me. And I might not care as much about the truth in those areas as you do. But there are certain things that are basic human concerns. They're fundamental concerns. They are the things that matter most to humanity and to individual humans. And so we are interested in the truth, even if we suspect that we'll never know the truth about the most important things. Now, that brings us to the second feature of the human cognitive condition. Not only are we ineluctably truth interested, but we are exquisitely evidence sensitive. So, and that's because we think that evidence is what puts us in touch with the truth, by and large. And so our interest in the truth combines with our capacity to collect, assess, and believe on the basis of evidence to be able to live responsibly in the world on the basis of things we believe. So that's the human condition in a nutshell, right? And there's the cognitive component is, I care about the truth, and my way of getting to the truth, the best chance I have of getting it right, is by in virtue of evidence. Those are evidence is what I have to go on in believing the things that I believe.
Okay. So if we're going to go based on the correspondence theory of truth, isn't it possible that someone's reality may be different than your own reality, or as they're experiencing reality?
Yeah. So what is the correspondence theory? You know, I don't want to sound too simplistic, but Aristotle's way of describing it was to say that if you have it, to believe of what is that it is true, and to believe of what is not that it is not is true, but to believe of what is that it is not is false, and to believe of what is not that it is false. So there needs to be a correspondence between how things are with respect to what your belief is about and then what you believe. So you want the thing your belief is about to match up with what your belief says about that thing or purports to be true about that thing. So your belief that God exists is true if there's a correspondence between what your belief is about God's existence and the actual existence of God. That's all it means to say that truth corresponds. It corresponds to reality. So that's just to back up from what you were saying. Yeah. Now, it could be that the reality that our beliefs are about is itself always in flux and changing, or maybe in some theoretical sense, it could be different for you than it is for me. But how it is for you is still going to be how it is for you. That's going to be a matter of objective truth, that the world that you encounter either is the way you believe it to be or it isn't. And it doesn't matter what I believe. It may be that it's a different world that I encounter than the world that you encounter. But your beliefs would still be objectively true or false based on whether or not there was a correspondence between your belief and the world that you encountered. Now, I believe that the world that you encounter and that the world that I encounter are the same, or at least they overlap. And so you and I encounter much of the same world. And that's why we're able to have a conversation and we're able to talk about these things and understand each other and use a vocabulary. And then if there's terms that you use that I'm not familiar with, and you can define them for me and so forth, and I can do the same, and we can get on common ground and we're talking about the same thing. We have different experiences of the same world and the same reality, and those differences in our experience can explain why we believe differently. But whether the things we believe are true or not really don't depend on our experiences. That is determined by the world itself, how the world actually is.
So by the fact that we can actually have conversations about these things and agreements and disagreements seems to suggest that there is an external world that actually is the case, that we can talk about it.
Yes, and if a person wants to say, you know, a person is going to insulate himself from the experience of others if he announces that he believes that his world is completely different than any world anybody else is encountering. And yet he seems, in making such a statement to us, to be regarding us as real features of his world. Now, maybe we're not. Maybe he believes that we're only features of his world and we have no independent existence and it's just, you know, a construction of his own consciousness or something. And then he's got some serious problems, right? And we know better because we know that our existence doesn't depend on his consciousness. So, you know, what do you do when you're dealing with a person like that? It's said, I don't know if this is actually literally the truth, but there's a legend according to which St. Augustine of Hippo was approached by someone who asked him, "Augustine, do I exist?" And Augustine said to him, "Who wants to know?" I think that was Augustine's complete answer to the question.
Yeah, seems like it.
And sometimes that's the right answer to a question is a question. Jesus made good use of that strategy himself quite often in his ministry. But you see, the problem is that if a person has doubts about his existence, one thing he can do is consider whether his doubt implies that he does exist. That was made famous by René Descartes in the 17th century.
Mm. Yeah. So which takes us, actually, this is a good segue to this next question, which is, can we know anything with certainty? For instance, the reliability of our senses or the laws of logic? If so, what would be the justification of these said beliefs?
Yes. Well, now we should probably distinguish between a psychological state and an epistemic condition. Hmm. A psychological state like certitude would be my own psychological state or outlook on something I believe, and I might feel very, very certain that what I believe is true, what I believe about something is true. Like maybe I, you know, do I have an orange tree in the backyard? And I might say, well, I feel certain. And that's a feeling. There's a psychological aspect of that. That's the certitude that I'm picking out. But what is the actual status of my belief? Do I have knowledge? Is it necessarily true? Is it certainly true? Now, I could have certainty as well as certitude. That is to say, I could have a very strong form of knowledge so that it's not possible to be mistaken, but also be psychologically convinced to a high degree. Now, maybe I could have certainty and be short on certitude. So those are two different kinds of things. Now, there are many things that we believe without having certainty. I don't think we have to have certainty in order to have knowledge in all cases, if we mean by that, that we could not be mistaken. Even with regard to an orange tree in my backyard, you know, maybe I've lived in my home for 25 years and I've watered that tree and pruned that tree and seen it grow, and I've plucked the fruit from the tree and eaten the fruit. And I did so as recently as yesterday. Let's suppose that's the case. Mm. Right now, the blinds to the window that looks out on the backyard here in my study are closed. I don't see an orange tree. Do I believe that there is an orange tree? Well, if I've had all those experiences, I probably do. And I probably have knowledge. But I haven't been out to my yard this today. And I don't know that somebody didn't come and remove the orange tree in the middle of the night. I would say I have knowledge that I have an orange tree. And in fact, if I was visiting you in your home right now and wasn't even able to look out the window and verify it, I would still say I know that I have an orange tree. Could I be mistaken? Yes, something could have happened, right? And I might not have an orange tree anymore as I have for so many years. In that case, I would think that I have knowledge and I would be mistaken about that. But if I'm not mistaken, then I think it's fair to say that I do have knowledge.
You know, sometimes I have an issue with doing philosophy of a certain sort. What you're saying is so commonsensical, right? It's just the way we live. It's the reality. You don't need an education. Many people historically and just around the world, we could say, who've been completely illiterate, lived and functioned based on these sorts of operations. For example, they went and planted whatever it may have been, and then when the season came to harvest that, they went and harvested it, and they didn't sit there and say, well, I need quite a bit of certainty, or I need certainty in order for me to make the journey, let's just say 30 minutes, to go and harvest whatever it was that I planted. They just went and did it. And to do otherwise, it seems to me, if we're going to require these sorts of certainties, let's just say, would mean like it's impossible to function on the day-to-day basis, or at the very least, it'd be very difficult to live your life if you needed certainty for every single decision you made.
Right. Well, you couldn't make a living, work a job and earn an income, and then use that to make life, you know, build projects and adopt hobbies, involve yourself in relationships and spend time with people and make plans together and do things together and so forth. All of these activities that are just part of the routine of life are built up on things that we believe and of course, things that we think we know. And we have knowledge in all sorts of domains about physical objects, about moral truths, about history, about things that happened in the past, in my own experience. So I have memories of what I had for breakfast this morning, or what where we went for entertainment last night. Those things are gone. I can't get those things before my mind in the same way that they were before my mind when they were happening. And so I know them differently now than I knew them when they were happening. And then I know things about past history, even predating my own existence, in other ways, not because I remember them, because I was never around for them, but because of testimony from others and so forth. And so all of these things that we believe make a difference to the texture of our lives, the quality of our lives, whether we're happy or sad, whether we're virtuous or not even. And I think virtue depends upon acquiring knowledge about what it is worth striving for, what character is worth seeking to inculcate in our lives, not just in our own lives, but if we're parents raising children, or if we feel responsible to others in our shared community and we want to build each other up, then we want to have good ideas about what is true and what is not true in the domain of virtue and morality. So yeah, it's pretty inescapable that we would have beliefs and that we would want our beliefs to be true insofar as we can get the truth on the evidence that we have.
That's very good. Yeah, because like one of the things I think about is like when I have conversations with my children. Mm-hmm. I remember maybe a month and a half ago. I was doing my research on various YouTube atheists, and I didn't realize my kids were around me. It was one of those things where I was laying down, I was on my phone, I was just watching a video, and the individual in the video said, "Well, God doesn't exist." And my daughter was next to me, who just turned 7. She said, "But God does exist." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Oh, she's around me." She actually, not that I really sheltered them from this. It's just I wasn't aware. And I said, "Well, yes, I believe so, and you believe so. But this individual in this video doesn't think that God exists." And she kind of just looked at me very puzzled and said, "But God does exist."
Right?
She's convinced, right? I suppose whether for her this sort of a belief in the existence of God, I mean, obviously that comes from us, and we have very open conversations in my mm-hmm. family, and I challenge the kids and ask them questions. Hey, why do you think God exists? And then so, you know, age appropriate sort of stuff, because I want them to be sharp in responding and thinking through these ideas well. Mm-hmm. Whether she says, "Well, I think God exists," and I just trust my dad for telling me that God exists, because my dad hasn't lied to me. Like he's not in the habit of lying to me, and so therefore I'm going to trust him for what he says. How reliable is that, right? In regards to trusting authority, because you were earlier talking about like trusting individuals, essentially, that our lives are just based on personal testimonies, for example, when it comes to historical data. Should we not just be like super skeptical as we approach personal testimony?
Well, obviously it's complicated. I mean, it isn't complicated in practice all the time. Children growing up with their parents or going to school or Sunday school, even peers having friends that know things, you know, they begin to believe things because that's what they're told. And the things that they're told are reinforced when they hear other people tell them the same things. So if you're talking to your daughter about some fact of American history, and then the next day she goes to school and she hears the same thing from her teacher, she's now got these two sources that she trusts saying the same thing. And that gives her more confidence. But if you told her one thing and the next day she went to school and her teacher said the opposite, that would be confusing. That would cause dissonance, because she believes that the teacher's supposed to be in the know about things like that. And she believes that you are too. You wouldn't have declared this, you wouldn't have made this factual claim if you didn't think you knew it. She could tell that the way you said it, you thought you were in the know. And all of this goes into the experience of believing on the basis of testimony. But when you get competing testimonies, right, from people that you trust, then that creates dissonance. And then you have to figure out a different way to sort out what to believe, because now disagreement between people you respect leaves you wondering who's right. And that doesn't mean that you lose your respect for those people. Another thing you learn over time is that authorities disagree with each other because they have beliefs about things they know about and they have expertise, so they're in a good position to believe responsibly, but they could be mistaken. And so you learn about that. And you have to learn as a kid growing up and getting older and maturing intellectually, you have to learn how to manage testimonial evidence from people who disagree with each other, or from people who dispute something that you've grown up believing. And that's just a commonality of human experience. And one of the things that we try to do when we're raising our kids is teach them how to navigate those waters at an age-appropriate level, so that when they're intellectually mature, they're able to do it on their own and do it well.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose it's interesting that this comment just came in that wouldn't it also be responsible to teach your child that people can be honestly mistaken? Yes, it would be. But it's very interesting to me because now there's an ethical requirement that's placed on beliefs. The idea that one would have to be, or that's the responsible thing to do, meaning it is a better thing to do than not to teach children that, hey, people honestly make mistakes, including your parents or your teachers. So how much of ethics has, how much impact does ethics have on epistemology?
Well, there is a topic in epistemology. Epistemology has to do with the nature of believing and justification and knowledge, and whether we can have knowledge and justified belief, and if so, on what basis and so forth. Those are the questions for epistemology. But one topic is called the ethics of belief. And some philosophers have put quite a bit of stress on what they call the ethics of belief. And then other philosophers have said that there really isn't a serious question here about the ethics of belief in epistemology. What's the concern? Well, the concern is about whether a belief that you have is a morally justified belief, whether it's epistemically justified or not. And there are examples that people give. So if you ever watch these, you know, the FBI profile shows or the, you know, courtroom scene shows or whatever, you have a mother whose son is arrested and, you know, on drug charges and maybe first degree murder or something. And the mother just cannot believe that her son did this action. And she feels that as the parent, she needs to support her son with conviction that he's innocent. Now, that might be the ethical thing to do if she's the mother, some would say, but it's not epistemically responsible. In other words, if she has the evidence that's now been presented in a court that would achieve a conviction of guilt, there's a sense in which she should not believe it. She should not believe it because all the evidence points the other way. Her son really is guilty. And so she ought to believe that he's guilty epistemically, even if she thinks she has a moral obligation as his mother to believe that he's innocent. Now, I think that you could have moral responsibilities in the domain of epistemically responsible belief, too. So I think that sometimes pride, a vice, gets in the way of our believing things when we have good evidence for them and we just wish they weren't true. And so that may be true. Let's suppose that God exists and somebody is insistent that God does not exist, but the evidence they have really does point to the existence of God. And I think that it is it's a moral fault, failure on their part may explain why they refuse the evidence, even though the evidence is as strong as they could require. So you could be, you know, blameworthy for not following the evidence, in other words, I think. And then, of course, there are other moral implications, because if you refuse, on some accounts, if you refuse to believe in God, even though the evidence is staring you in the face, then you could be faced with moral judgment for refusing to act as if God exists with worship and obedience and so forth.
Wouldn't we say the same thing to an individual that hasn't really cared about looking at the evidences for God's existence or not? Let's say they do believe in God exists, and they believe Christianity is true. And then say they have a child, and the child becomes an atheist and says, hey, I've looked at the evidence, and the evidence convinces me that, you know, God doesn't exist. And then they approach, say, the parent, and the parent says, I don't care about any of that. Now, it seems to me that they're being proud in that moment. Even if I would agree with them that the conclusion that they have is true, that God exists, I would still say that they're, to a certain extent, blameworthy of approaching the subject in such a manner.
Yes. And when we're, this is where you could have certitude without certainty. And that could be even in the area of Christian belief. So you could believe the right things about God and Jesus and the Bible and so forth, but not believe them in a very responsible way. So on the one hand, it would be good that you believe what's true, but not so good that you believe it without appropriate grounding, especially when the grounds are available. And it, you know, if you applied yourself, you would be able to make use of that evidence. People feel threatened by evidence sometimes because they fear that on the evidence, they may have to conclude that what they believed wasn't true after all. And the only way you can see that through is by facing the evidence, sifting through it, and then making determinations about its strength. But some are reluctant to make those are reluctant to engage in that process because it does. It is still an open question before you engage in the process what you're going to believe as a result of doing those things. And certainly when you have core beliefs about the things that matter most, no matter what they are, your beliefs could be very different than mine, but when you have core beliefs about the things that matter most, your lives tend to be built around those beliefs, and it can be very destabilizing personally for an individual to suddenly wonder, well, have I been sold a bill of goods here? And have I believed things that I shouldn't believe after all? Because now on the evidence, it looks to me like I was mistaken. And that is destabilizing. Now, conversion happens when things that you believe about very fundamental truths or propositions change and shift. And that we call it conversion to respect the dramatic difference in belief that you've now acquired and the difference that it can make in the way you think about your life and live your life, you plan your life. But that's a risk that we have to take if we want to believe what's true and we want to believe responsibly, is that we need, as we mature intellectually, to be thoughtful about the state of our evidence at a given time. That's going to change from the time that your daughter is 7 to the time that she's 17 to the time that she's 27.
Correct.
And I've seen this I was thinking about a conversation I had with my second daughter when she was 7. She came to me and she said, you know, Dad, I wonder if we could go for a walk. I've got something I want to talk about with you. And so I could tell this was quite serious for her and important. This was a new thing. She'd never done this before. So we went outside and we started to walk around the block. And she just kind of was chatty for a few minutes, and we got about halfway around, and there was a low block wall that we could sit on right here. And she said, "Dad, could we just stop here and sit for a minute? And I want to talk to you." And I said, "Well, sure." And she said, we sat down, and she said, "Dad, I don't want you to take this personally. I believe in God, and I believe in Jesus. I believe the Bible. I do." She said, "But I'm just a little person, and I don't know if I should believe these things because I don't know all the things that you know or that other people know. And I know that there are people who don't believe these things. And so what am I supposed to do? I can only manage what I know." And so, you know, I complimented her. I said, "I love the way you think, Aaron. And I really respect that. And you're asking a very deep question. It's a very important question. And it's not the last time you'll have this question." And I think I must have said 3 or 4 more times how much I love the way she thinks while I was trying to figure out what I was going to say to her. But I said, "Well, now tell me why it is that you believe these things. You say you believe that there is a God, and you believe that Jesus is his son, the Bible is the word of God. Why do you believe those things?" And she told me, and she gave me evidence. And she said, she said, "Part of it is that this is the way you've taught me." And I said, "Now, what is that? Why would you believe me, though?" And she said, "Well, I know that you think about these things a lot, and that you have done a lot of reading, and that you know the arguments on both sides, and that you've done debates, and I've gone to your debates. And that's true." And she says, "And you always win," which might not be true. But she said, I can't think at that level. I'm only 7 years old. And I said, "Okay, well, maybe the evidence you have is good enough for now. And you're fine believing what you believe today about those things. But as you get older, you'll want to get better at collecting the evidence, weighing the evidence, and drawing your own conclusions. That you won't just be believing this because of the reasons you give me now, when you're older and you're able to manage a more sophisticated case. And she was fine with that. And she said, okay. And I said, so, you know, we can talk about this again later, you know, and if you ever have any questions, we can try to sort through the evidence together. And you'll just get better at it as you go and mature intellectually and probably surpass me someday. And if that happens, then you'll be giving me some ideas about what it is reasonable to believe. But right now, it seems that you're justified in believing the things you believe for the reasons that you gave me.
Very good.
And that was that. We just got up and finished our walk and talked about other things.
So that's just a nice lesson for folks who don't think they can have conversations of this sort with their 7-year-olds.
Yeah, well, it's clear that our 7-year-olds and earlier children or younger than that even come to us. And I've always taken children's questions very seriously. I don't mean that I give them a graduate level lecture in response to a question, but I do try to get clear about what they're asking. I find that if I ask them follow-up questions, they have a deeper grasp and a more sincere sense of things than we tend to give them credit for. We might think, well, they're too young to really understand what they're asking. Well, that's not necessarily the case. When my oldest was younger than this, she was in a stroller and we were going around the neighborhood and I used to ask her, you know, what does a certain kind of animal sound like? And she would say, and you know, who made that? Well, God did. And then finally one day I said, well, who made God? And she said, Dad, as if to say, what kind of a stupid question is that? And from her point of view, it was kind of a ridiculous question because she understood that God is the sort of being that doesn't require a cause. She was young, but she apprehended that there could be something that is of that sort, where everything else would need a cause, but God would not. There is an uncaused cause of things. Now, she couldn't get into the metaphysics of it and do, you know, and you know, talk about Thomas Aquinas or Gottfried Leibniz or any of these people. But that didn't matter. She still could apprehend the concept, I think, at an appropriate level for her age.
Right. Talking about metaphysics a little bit. do you think, now this is my personal conclusion, so you might not agree with me, but do you think that when it comes to presuppositionalism, there's some kind of a confusion when it comes to epistemology and ontology?
So I have been talking about evidence a certain way, and it would be clear to some people that what I've said about evidence implies that I'm not a presuppositionalist, that I think that to have a justified belief, you have to have evidence. And that is my view. And there are people who disagree. Now, when I was talking about knowledge and I said that in order to have knowledge, you have to have an appropriately grounded true belief for that, I didn't say anything about evidence initially. My view is that to be appropriately grounded is to have evidence of the right sort. But some people think that a belief could be appropriately grounded without evidence. And that includes people in the presuppositionalist tradition of Christian apologetics. There are a couple of different ways that presuppositionalism is understood, and the issues are actually fairly complex. But on one view, it's almost like a fideism, where you simply believe in a kind of dogmatic way and without evidence or anything to go on. You just start off with belief, and then you have to operate from that point of view. You believe by faith. I think that's a confusion. I think that faith can be either grounded or not grounded. It could be reasonable or unreasonable. A more sophisticated version, though, of this view is that when we operate cognitively, we necessarily make certain presuppositions, assumptions about how reason works and what follows from things that we believe and why, what logical truths we are using when we reason as we do. And this is unavoidable, and all human beings have instincts for these things and their right to function this way. But the ultimate explanation for this has to be theological, that our capacity to do this must be because God created us to function with the right faculties that emulate the logic of the world in some way or other. And they think that if you use reason at all, you are in effect presupposing God. And so an atheist is presupposing God in reasoning against the existence of God. And I don't find this to be very convincing myself, and I haven't known very many atheists who found it convincing either. I think it's one thing to say that when you reason, you are using faculties that God designed for good purposes, and maybe even to say that if God did not exist, these things would not be true. But that's not the same thing as saying that when you reason, you are yourself presupposing that there is a God. Hmm. I think that is mistaken. I don't think that I am presupposing that necessarily. I may think that that's the best explanation for my ability to reason as I do. I think that's generally on the right track, actually. But that doesn't mean that I have the presupposition as a matter of personal conviction lurking somewhere in the deep recesses of my soul, or I wouldn't be reasoning at all. I would say that it would have to, you know, there must be a God who fashioned a universe in the way that he did so that it could be known in the ways that we know it.
Yeah, which is the ontological sort.
I wouldn't have to have the belief that that's the case in order to be a reasonable person.
Understood.
It might be unreasonable for me to believe that God does not exist, given the need to explain reason by appeal to God. But that doesn't mean that when I am reasoning, I am presupposing that God exists.
Yeah. We gotta finish up here. But have you written anything where you aim at solving the Gettier problem?
Right. So I don't know if we can assume that everybody listening to this knows Correct. What that problem is.
That was a question that was asked. So that's why.
Oh, you've been asked that while we've been
talking? That was specifically asked of you. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what the Gettier problem is, and then we'll talk about whether you've written to solve it.
Well, I have not written what I consider a good approach to the problem. Edmund Gettier was thinking about the nature of knowledge and this definition of knowledge that we alluded to earlier called JTB, or justified true belief, J for justification, T for truth, and B for belief. The JTB theory holds that you have knowledge if and only if you have a justified true belief. What that means then is that there are, that everything you believe, everything you know is a justified true belief, and every justified true belief you have is knowledge, right? Now, he thought he could give counterexamples to this general claim, this generalization. And if there is a good legitimate counterexample to a generalization, then the generalization is false. So if, for example, we come back to the all ravens are black example, if somebody can produce an example of a raven that's not black, well, then that generalization is false. Even if there's only one example of a raven that's not black, the general claim has to be false. Now, when we say that all knowledge, or every time you have a justified true belief, you have knowledge, if we say that, we're making a general statement about knowledge. But he thought that he could give examples of justified true beliefs that are not instances of knowledge. Now, it would take a while to go through his examples, even though the article in which he wrote it up is fairly short. It's only a few pages, but it would take a while to go through the example. I think that the problem here is that the epistemic constraint, that is, that the belief be justified, is not explained adequately to capture what it is about justification that contributes to knowledge. And so that's why I think it's better to speak of adequately grounded true belief and not merely justified true belief. I was actually thinking of cases like Gettier's own examples, which he thought were counterexamples to JTB. So one approach would be to say that, yes, these are counterexamples to JTB, but we can solve the problem by talking more about what the justification condition is. And if that means adequately grounded true belief, then we have to say, well, when is belief adequately grounded such that you have knowledge? And I think you could do that in a way that circumvented the examples that Gettier gave in his brief article.
Is there anything you could recommend someone might read in regards to the direction you're taking this in?
Yes, I do recommend a book that I have used most recently in my courses in epistemology by Richard Feldman, and it's just called Epistemology. I don't know if when you took your course in epistemology...
I have it sitting there. I just don't want to reach over and grab it.
That you might have used that book at the time. And I think that's very good. That's a very good book. And he explains the Gettier problem, called that because it arises in this article by Edmund Gettier, and looks at various attempts to solve the problem. Some of them are subtle and difficult to understand on your own, but if you work at it, I think you can sort it out for the most part, or at least I thought it was a pretty good introductory discussion of the problem. And I thought that ultimately the solution that he offered is pretty congenial. He's an evidentialist himself. And so we have common ground in that regard as well. It's one reason why I use his book. Richard Feldman, Feldman, a book called Epistemology.
Correct. Okay. I guess there's some personal questions and it will be done.
Okay.
When you were studying at USC, was Dallas Willard one of the profs there?
Yes, he was my advisor for my dissertation.
There we go. That's for Occam's Razor who asked that question. So you... did he leave influences on you? And this is my question, I guess. Did he leave influences on you when it comes to his spiritual formation kind of ideology?
Yes, he did. And that was partly because through his teaching, to be sure, which didn't come out so much in the courses that he taught at USC as they did in his writings and various lectures, some of which I attended, others I've seen on YouTube and so forth. Conversations, of course, with him. But I think that much of what I've said about epistemology tracks with some of the things that he used to teach as well as a philosopher. People who know his work or have been through his courses may even have suspected some influence on my thinking in that regard. And then with regard to the spiritual life, you know, he had so much to say about the fruit of the spirit, the virtues, and how these grow in our lives through spiritual disciplines of various sorts. His teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, his understanding of what it is to trust God, very influential on me. I would say, for example, that when I'm faced with a new situation where, let's say, now I'm in a position, I'm a free agent where I could I have greater freedom in my schedule now to lecture and to take on book projects and so forth because I'm no longer teaching where I was teaching. I could, for that matter, take a job somewhere else and continue teaching full time. But it would be very easy for my ego to get in the way of discerning God's will and leading in my life. And Dallas was very influential in my thinking in this matter, that we really do need to wait on him and not always be pressing hard to get doors to open in the direction that we want them to, and suspect that if they do, that's automatically what he wants for us, that we can trust in his providence to provide for us. And this means that even when doors are slammed in our faces or opportunities do not emerge when we want them to or expect them to, he's still in charge and he's still superintending the process that goes on in our lives, and he is accomplishing other purposes in our lives that we might not be thoughtful about. Or at least he could be if we were pliable and humble in his use of providence in our lives to bring us around to greater maturity in spiritual things, which is more important than what I happen to be doing at a given moment to make a living or what have you.
Okay. Finally, I'll ask this and then I'm going to let you go. Someone would like to know what you think is the best argument against radical skepticism.
Well, I always ask the person who is skeptical, why would you be so skeptical? I mean, what reason would you have for being skeptical? I was in a roundtable discussion with a group of students at a university in another state in the country a few years ago, and this came up. The student said, "Hey, I'm a skeptic, and I believe I've been moved by the brain in a vat argument. I think that it's possible that I'm just a brain in a vat, and that I'm not having the experiences that it seems to me that I'm having." And every belief that I have could be something that is being caused in a brain, just lying inertly in a vat with no body attached, by some mad scientist. And I can't rule out that possibility. This is a pretty extreme form of skepticism. And you don't often meet people who are convinced by the brain in the vat argument that we don't have knowledge. They just think that it's a very serious problem that we need to overcome, and they're not quite sure how to do it. But my response to that is simply to say, well, look, I think I have good evidence that I'm not a brain in a vat, and I'm going with the evidence that I have. And I have no evidence that I am a brain in a vat. I don't think you have evidence that you are either. Your confidence is frustrated by the mere possibility that you think is an intelligible, coherent possibility. But I wouldn't want to build my life on what was merely a possibility, because it's also possible that things are exactly as they seem to you, that you're not a brain in a vat. You are a living human being, part of a community, and we are having this conversation just as you seem to yourself to be having this conversation. And I would say that if that's a possibility and your evidence points to that possibility, then that's what you should believe. You should not be worried that you are a brain in a vat, because that's merely a hypothetical possibility.
Thank you. Well, as we go, I want to remind you guys that if you're very, and you should be, like, this is a book that if you're interested in the subject, you can eat this book up, because it's got so many solid thinkers in it, both of a religious and non-religious variety. And you guys did a great job of editing it and putting it together. I always go back to this. This was a required reading for one of the classes I took. I'm not sure which one. You would know better. But I regularly go back to this because I think even the arguments presented by the atheists are the best arguments that could be presented. So I want to deal with the best stuff that is coming at us from the other side. And again, you've written on film. You've written on the NAR we mentioned, most recent works that you've done. The links to that are in the description box. And I want to thank you so much for taking so much time out of your day to jump on and have this discussion.
I enjoyed this conversation. And I would say that if your audience would pick up a copy of Counterfeit Kingdom and read that book, they would see how, even on a topic like that, the issues that we've discussed they're of paramount significance. You know, people are making miracle claims today. They claim to have the authority authority of a prophet or an apostle. They make prophetic, predictive prophecies that don't come true. And there are questions about how we should evaluate this. But you don't need to be a philosopher to read and to understand this book. And yet, I think if you have listened to this conversation and then you were to pick up that book, you might see how some of the sophisticated concepts that we've talked about could play a role in your deliberations about the New Apostolic Reformation.
Correct. And if for somebody, before people go off and say all sorts of stuff about you before thinking, you've also written a book or co-edited a book on miracles, correct?
Yes.
And that one was called what? I'm trying to pull it up.
It's a book edited with Gary Habermas. Mm-hmm. And published by InterVarsity Press, called In Defense of Miracles, A Comprehensive Case for God's Action in History, I think it is, or maybe it's in the world. I forget which of those two. And that book is now, that's also a collection of essays. A couple of essays by figures who deny the miraculous, and then the rest by Christian philosophers who respond to the various objections to belief in the miraculous. And so I have a chapter in there, Gary does, but so does William Lane Craig, Steve Davis, Richard Pertill, many other very good philosophers, Christians all, describing what miracles are, how you can identify miracles, articles about the specific miracle, the resurrection of Jesus, for example. And
it's still in print, and I just realized it's also on Audible.
Is it? I haven't seen it on Audible. Yeah. I know that the Audible version of Counterfeit Kingdom is very good. I've listened to a lot of books myself, and sometimes the narration is great, excellent, and it's a good listening experience. And sometimes it's not so good. And we were really pleased with the Audible version of Counterfeit Kingdom. I haven't heard the version of this book, In Defense of Miracles.
Yeah, but I just noticed it is. So that's always a good thing.
Yes.
Definitely. I think for those who have some more questions, maybe one of these days when we circle back around our guests, then we will have Dr. Guyvett back on to have maybe discussions of a different sort. But I know epistemology was so close to his heart, and he's so good at explaining things and bringing it down to a level where folks listening can understand. I really wanted to have this discussion. Again, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for
joining
that.
Me for this. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you guys for watching or listening to this whenever or wherever this may be. Don't forget that tomorrow we have a celebratory live stream. I think we're going to be on for like 5 hours. We have guests coming in because we're going to celebrate the fact that we hit 4,000 subscribers, and just going to have friends on. We're going to have discussions of various sorts. So look forward to that. That's our usual Friday Q&A. We're just going to extend it to 5 hours, and feel free to jump in, and we'll open it up for you guys to call in as well. With all that said, God bless you guys, and I will see you guys tomorrow. Take care.